Good morning. Current and coming cuts to Hawaii newspapers are continuing proof of the digital migration. UH Communications Professor Brett Oppegard looked at whether we're really watching papers becoming obsolete. For years, Hawaii kids have been encouraged to eat healthy food to counter years of increasing childhood obesity. Now a study is measuring the nexus of obesity and malnutrition in Hawaii, Alaska, and U.S.-affiliated Pacific states. We'll get details from its lead author, Rachel Novotny. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The story of Momotaro, the Peach Boy, has been called one of the greatest ever told. It's coming back to the Honolulu Theater for Youth. And director Eric Johnson is with us to tell us more. And the Kilauea Drama and Entertainment Network presents a look back at the centennial of Kilauea Military Camp by bringing its cast of characters to life on stage.
That's the conversation for Monday, August 8th. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. This is The Conversation. And to my right, in a t-shirt that has, I think, what is that, Route 61?
Highway 61.
Highway 61 on your t-shirt.
Blues Highway.
There you go.
Yeah.
My favorite blues man, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Looking at the dual problems of obesity and malnutrition, which would seem to contradict one another.
Exactly. But as we have seen and we'll talk about this morning, not necessarily so. Now, since 2007, the obesity rate for high school students in Hawaii from low-income families has been slowly edging lower. According to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, it's now at 12.9%. Still, though, that's enough to put Hawaii's low-income high school kids in the middle of U.S. states' childhood obesity rates. For the past 2 years, a new study has looked beyond Hawaii and into remote Pacific states to gauge the intersection of childhood obesity and malnutrition. The Children's Healthy Living Program for Remote Underserved Minority Populations in the Pacific Region is a partnership among Alaska, American Samoa, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, Guam, the Federated States of Micronesia, Hawaii, the Republic of Palau, and the Republic of the Marshall Islands. Dr. Rachel Novotny is the program's principal investigator, and she's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Not bad, thanks, and hope you're doing well. Looking at how this study was crafted to be able to look at how much, you know, stunting was happening at birth versus how much stunting was happening currently. Stunting seems to be a word that we don't use a whole lot. How do you define that in terms of that nexus of malnutrition and obesity?
Yes, we use several different measures of malnutrition or undernutrition. So we're really looking at the whole nutrition spectrum, looking at undernutrition and overnutrition. So stunting relates to height, growth in height among children. And then we also look at underweight as well. And then, of course, on the other end, we look at overweight using the body mass index parameter. So we've been looking at the whole range throughout the region.
As we have been told for many years, Hawaii's kids, small children all the way through high school, on a trajectory to becoming more and more obese. But that seemed to level off in recent years, perhaps in part to some of the messaging that we've heard here. But as you looked out into the Pacific to see what, you know, this looked like with kids of all ages, what specifically did you find in the way of any messaging at all to be able to stop some of this or to be able to undercut it?
Well, since as you framed for us, we're looking at a vast region with a vastly varied environment. And so first, what we see is that environment does vary and does influence what we see. And so one of the ways we think about it is in terms of westernization or urbanization or modernization, and that influence on our lifestyles, on what we eat, on our physical activity and the policies and environments around us that influence that. So we look at a population level at the variability. And what we're seeing is that, as you might expect, in the countries or the jurisdictions that are more traditional and just having Western influences, we see more of the undernutrition prevalence, the higher rates of undernutrition. But as the countries become more modern and more urbanized, that improves, but then the obesity begins to increase. So you see in the middle these areas where they're actually experiencing still both. So there's quite a high level of undernutrition, but also the emerging obesity. And as we're seeing in Hawaii, that does seem to level off at the very highest levels of westernization or urbanization. But we also have populations within populations. So, for example, in Hawaii, we have, we have those who are better off and we have those who are not as well off. And we do see that whole range even within Hawaii.
So looking at those who are more well off as opposed to those who are not so, is there a better place to be? I mean, because it used to be that, you know, people who were very wealthy were the ones who would become more obese. And then with more modern food production, a lot of heavily commercialized products, things that looked really good, very attractive, that the obesity rate became higher sort of at all levels. And then it became where people became very in touch with a health movement if they were at a higher economic level. That seems to be in somewhat parallel to what you've just described that you found as you went out into the Pacific. Does that also mean that, you know, with enough messaging and enough assistance, that can be moved into the same kind of path that we've seen happen here in Hawaii with kids leveling off at a certain age and not becoming so obese?
Yes, I think you've said that well, that there is an opportunity to manage our environment so that we're got the healthy environment to prevent the obesity. It is something we have to work at, and I think to get policies into place and to help those who may not be able to manage their resources as well is one of the challenges we have as a society. But yes, I think we do see at that very upper end an ability to manage that and turn to what may be in some cases more expensive, but nonetheless recognized as being healthy food products. But we have the opportunity to put into place policies to make that available for more people and to manage the foods that we eat and the physical environments that we live in. And I think those are the kinds of take-home messages to take from the work.
Dr. Novotny, as you talk about what could happen, what policies might be driven by this, there's also the question of how do you do this without necessarily being seen as the interloper? And with respect for the fact that you're talking about other cultures, other ways of being, but that have been clearly looking at, U.S. products as being desirable.
Well, yes, I think each jurisdiction needs to make those decisions, but hopefully these types of data provide them with decision-making information. And that is, in fact, one of the main reasons we engaged in this, because this region, although related to the U.S., has not been a part of the U.S. surveys, not even Hawaii. And so there's been a lack of this kind of data to help us in our decision-making as we think about these issues for our communities.
So what happens next in terms of continual look at data or outreach to be able to get more of it?
Well, there's a number of things. One, we are aiming to continue to collect this data to watch trends over time, but we've also been engaged in an intervention program in some of the jurisdictions, and we're just beginning to get the results of that. But the effort of that was to specifically work on changing community environments to see, to demonstrate really what could be done to decrease and prevent child obesity over time. So those results will be coming out soon and will be additional information to help suggest specific ways that to manage our environments to prevent obesity. Because, of course, we want to do our best to prevent with this information, you know, for those jurisdictions that are experiencing influences mm-hmm. of westernization and modernization and urbanization, to be able to learn from others and prevent going through all of the health problems that those and ahead of them have gone through.
Dr. Novotny, we'll look forward to that additional data coming forward and being able to talk to you again. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Dr. Rachel Novotny directs the Nutritional Assessment of Populations Program at UH Manoa and is the principal investigator for the Children's Healthy Living Program for remote underserved minority populations in the Pacific.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15, and coming up, the story of a hero born inside a peach. But first, your quiz.
Last week, we asked you a backyard quiz about Akebono, and no one got it right, so we're trying another sumo question on you today about another Hawaii-born pioneer in the national sport of Japan. He was the first man from Hawaii to become a professional sumo wrestler in Japan and the first non-Japanese wrestler ever to win a professional tournament there. He was born on Maui in 1944 and moved to Japan to seek his fortune when he was 19 years old, soon after graduating from Baldwin High School. He trained hard in his early years, and 4 years after he got there, he was promoted to Makuuchi, the sport's top division. He had an unusually long 20-year career, retiring after an injury when he was 39 years old. He set several records, including one for longevity, competing in 1,425 consecutive bouts. After he retired, he became a trainer to young athletes in Japan, where he remains a hero of the sport. This morning, we're looking for either of the names by which he's known, and we'll come back with them in about half an hour. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Rick Broadwell, Honolulu jazz trumpet player. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There's a reason why folk tales endure. In them, you can see the roots of all storytelling. The story of Momotaro, the hero who comes to Earth inside a giant peach, goes back centuries, told and retold in hundreds of adaptations. Honolulu Theater for Youth's modern-day take on the story is called Anime Momotaro 2016. HTY's Eric Johnson is a co-creator of the show, which opens this weekend, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. It's lovely to be here.
Let's set the stage by saying what this story is, or sort of summing it up to the degree it can be. Yeah?
Absolutely. This is one of the most famous Japanese folktales of all time. It's been, as you said in your introduction, been adapted so many different ways. And consequently, it is also one of the most famous local stories that this community. I was just talking to someone on my way in who played Inu's Tale in a production. And so I think there have been lots of stagings here in Hawaii. This is a favorite piece that we had done at HTY about 6 years ago. And we're so excited to bring it back, souped up and ready to go in the future. It's the story of a boy who springs from a peach. His family is being plagued by ogres who steal lots of their vegetables and crops and things like that. And he sets off bravely as the strongest in all Japan to go and face those ogres with the help of a dog, a monkey, and a bird.
Anyone who's ever dealt with ogres can identify, right?
Right, right. And I think, you know, as this was traditionally, it was a cautionary tale in Japan to warn, you know, the roving samurai, especially in times of famine, you know, not to get too greedy with the common people or they would be usurped is one interpretation of it. And so when we were adapting this piece, we really thought about, well, what is a balance of power look like, an imbalance of power look like for young people right now?
Yeah.
And so we've really turned this piece into a piece about, you know, what does it mean as a bully, you know, to if you are being bullied, if people are treating you unjustly, how do you stand up to that in a modern way? And we've taken some liberties with the story. Instead of, you know, just killing all the ogres, he has a revelation and a more peaceful solution to this problem. But one of the things that brought us back to this story is that I think that issue of how does a young person deal with an imbalance of power in their life, and how do you bring humility and generosity and but also firmness to that situation is something that a new generation needs to see.
You know, I think, Eric, as kids come of age, understanding the dynamics of power is one of the more difficult things that you're going to face as you grow up, right? Who's got the power? How is it wielded? How do you get some? How do you resist it if it's harmful in some way, right?
Absolutely. And I think there are so many examples in the adult world that aren't healthy for young people to take in, that it's so important and for families to turn to art and to culture and to look at the best examples of humanity and stories that we have that teach us that these situations need to be rectified. And that is done through a community. And in the Momotaro story, he has this community of animals. He has his community that he is standing up for. And in our production specifically, there are, even within the ogre community, there are upstanders who kind of stand out and realize that what they're doing is unjust in the end.
I love that phrase, the ogre community. You know, it just has a ring to it, doesn't it?
Right. And I think that's, you know, we are using the style. We're using two different styles, the style of anime. Uh-huh. And so even our ogres, although pretty ferocious at times, are also adorably cute. They have big, colorful, furry headpieces that were designed for them. And in that way, I think we're making the story accessible. We're saying this is good for any child 5 and over, and we're hoping, you know, we get lots of grandparents and parents bringing young people of all ethnicities, not just Japanese, but to share in a traditional cultural story in this way.
And you know, it gets away from the element that is common to so many folk tales where problems are solved by slaying somebody.
Right, right, exactly. There is a specific moment where we veer away from that in this production.
Yeah.
And I think that said, I think there is, with the including the anime in the way the piece looks, and we have, you know, changes in perspectives, and we have big slow motion action sequences and things that you might only see in a drawing or in a cartoon. We're able to stage those. So not only is there a traditional aspect of the story that a grandparent can share with a young audience, but there is a stylistic element that a young person could share with their grandparent here. And I think that is that makes this production very exciting for us.
And it's very much anime is very much a visual language that kids really these days especially understand, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we had the great fortune, we did this production here, and then we took it to D.C., and it actually won the Helen Hayes Award for Best Theater for Young Audience production in D.C. that year. And we did some changes and tweaks, and we're bringing it back even more expanded. But I think that that really spoke to the feeling that the piece was something unique. It was something that they had never seen before in D.C., but something we see all the time done so well here, which is Asian stories and styles with a Western sensibility so that both of those communities can engage with it.
If it's going to happen anywhere, it's going to happen here, right?
I think so. I think this is our creative, fertile soil that has been, prepped for many, many generations of people here.
Makes sense to me. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thank you, Chris.
Eric Johnson is the co-creator of Anime Momotaro 2016, based on the Japanese folktale. It opens Friday and runs until September 24th with a Japanese language performance on that date.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA Remodel It Right Expo, featuring 3 days of seminars designed to help with home remodeling projects, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Blaisdell, biahawaii.org.
About 18 months ago, Honolulu became the most expensive city in which to build just about anything. It surpassed New York, yes, New York, for that title. Other expensive cities, including several in California, weren't even close. So why is it so expensive to build in Honolulu? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, some people might have, the immediate reaction of saying that, well, look, we have to bring everything in here. We don't have a steel industry. We don't have a lumber industry. This is all part of what goes into those costs. But we also have a very tight labor market. Is that the real reason?
Well, that's what John Hill, our reporter, has discovered talking to a lot of folks, industry experts. And sure, we import so much. Boy, we've talked a lot about that on this program. You know, the energy, the food, just about everything in Hawaii is more expensive than it is on the mainland. I can't think of much that isn't. But the fact that we have a sort of a thin labor pool, that it's stretched thin, brings potential risk in not having enough qualified workers to actually do the jobs. And therefore, when things like rail come in much more expensive, or even those air conditioning units for public schools, this is one of the main reasons experts say that costs are so high. There just isn't enough qualified workers to go around.
So perhaps that the jobs might not be done as well as if you had a lot of competition for people who were trying to get the jobs done on time, to budget, and finish them appropriately.
Right. And you mentioned importing things. Well, of course, we actually have to import workers a lot of times, primarily from the West Coast. And remember, it's not like a worker in Los Angeles is driving to Phoenix in his car, right? His or her car to go to work. They're actually being flown over. They're going to have to be put up in housing. They're going to be flown back for visitation. So that stuff, those kind of costs really add to the whole dimension. By the way, construction jobs in Honolulu recently jumped 16%. That tied us for fifth among U.S. metro areas. So clearly, the work is there. We are in a construction boom cycle right now.
When somebody goes to get an estimate, though, you try to rely on that as being, you know, fairly reasonable, whether you're a consumer or whether you're putting up a major project. How does that affect the outcomes? Because we, you know, watching rail and thinking, well, was that really a good estimate going in? Did we really know as much as we could have? How good was the forecast? All of that. And some of it obviously is unknown, but is there something to be said for how the estimates are done?
No question. Faulty initial estimates, as we know very well from the rail project, really help escalate the cost of construction, and that is something that has to be factored in as well. Then there's also the fact that some contractors just aren't as productive as others. There's a difficulty in finding subcontractors that are qualified. And then finally, it's interesting enough, one area where we're particularly different than the mainland is single-family homes are just about the most expensive thing to construct here, less so for shopping centers and street parking and elementary schools. But single-family homes, well, no coincidence, they are the most expensive in the nation here on Oahu.
As anybody who's been building recently or trying to do a remodel will tell you that you have to continually build in for change orders. Anyway, thanks very much, Ted. I'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check from Civil Beat.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet, as well as what we can look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in the evening sky. Jupiter will be the first planet to set at around 8:20 p.m., followed by Mars at around midnight. All three planets can be seen in the southern sky after sunset. The moon this week is passing through its first quarter phase and will continue to brighten towards the end of the week. So catch those dark skies while you can.
And something very special is on our way in terms of things to look for, and that is a meteor shower.
Yes, this week we are treated to a wonderful celestial phenomena, the Perseid meteor shower. The Perseid meteor shower is expected to be quite impressive this year, with meteor numbers expected to be at a maximum of around 200 per hour under perfect visible conditions. This meteor shower will begin to pick up around about midnight on Friday, August the 11th, and it will run through to the 13th. To see it, look to the north in the direction of the constellation of Perseus, which is right below the distinct W shape of the constellation of Cassiopeia.
And what accounts for the extra number of meteors this year, Chris?
Well, this is all down to the position of the Earth as it orbits the Sun. You see, meteor showers are caused when the Earth passes through the trail of cosmic dust and debris left by a passing comet. Normally, we skirt this stream of debris, but this year, Jupiter's gravity has affected the stream, causing it to bunch up as the Earth passes through it. That means we're going to see a higher than normal number of meteors.
And what is the phenomena exactly that we're taking a look at?
Well, the Perseid meteor shower originates from debris left over from the comet Swift Tuttle, which last passed through the solar system in 1992. As it made its way through the solar system, its tail left a trail of dust and debris that has lingered in space. Every year, we pass through this dust cloud and we experience the Perseid meteor shower.
And how big are the individual meteors?
These meteors vary in size from a grain of sand to some that are around an inch in size. Nothing terribly formidable. However, they travel very, very fast at speeds of around 133,000 miles per hour.
Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Good morning. I'm Senator Mazie Hirono. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, what do you do when a cut doesn't heal right away?
Well, you know, if it gets infected, you get it checked out ASAP. We're seeing a lot of unique infections these days, things that we used to just see in the hospital, things like there's an acronym MRSA, or MRSA, which is actually out there in the community and can infect wounds. And so we're going to talk today about what about the harder-to-heal wounds, not just the infected ones, but the ones that just seem to take forever. What are some things that people need to know to make sure they're not in a position where they have some major wound that in some cases can be disastrous? We're talking skin grafts and all sorts of things.
Kathy, it's really important what you do right after you sustain the injury, right?
It is. A lot of people think, oh, it's just a little cut. Let me go back in the ocean or go back to what I'm doing. And when you have an open wound, if you go into a location where there's potential for bacteria, and we kind of know what's been going on with sewage spills and everything else like that, then you're actually just opening it up to infection. You're just welcoming it right in. And if that isn't taken care of immediately, whether it be peroxide or alcohol or covering it or antibiotic topical ointment, then it really is something that could turn into something pretty nasty pretty quickly.
Kathy, the old-time remedies like peroxide, mercurochrome, things like that, are they still prevail?
You can use them. I mean, peroxide, something simple. Keep some in your car if you tend to go out into the ocean a lot. That way you can go ahead and sanitize things. You know, peroxide doesn't hurt when you put it on. Alcohol stings really bad. So I always advocate people keep peroxide, particularly some of the surfers or some of the outdoor enthusiasts. Just keep some in your car just in case. In a little spray bottle, it can really make all the difference.
Sounds like good advice, Kathy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
A year ago, the New York Times surpassed the 1 million mark of paid digital-only subscribers. 3 months ago, the paper announced it would offer buyout packages to newsroom and business department employees to continue their aggressive focus on the digital product. That story is just one of many we've heard over the last decade as papers have been closed or tried to retrofit themselves to fit the digital migration of readers. Now it's happening, some would say, again, at Hawaii's newspapers. The publisher of the Honolulu Star-Advertiser says cuts are coming to that paper following cuts already made at other papers it owns. We called Assistant Journalism Professor Brett Oppegard to see what he makes of Hawaii's ever-changing newspaper landscape, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We've been watching this happen for quite a long time, not just in Hawaii, but truly, you know, across the country, watching major publications go under. And I think, you know, there are many people who remember there was, you know, quite a movement in Honolulu to keep it a two-paper town well before the Star-Advertiser and the Honolulu Star, well, the Star-Advertiser became the Star-Advertiser. As you look at the situation now, are we really looking at the beginning of the end and newspapers truly becoming obsolete?
Well, this was definitely a terrible year last year for newspapers. This was really the worst year since the Great Recession hit in 2007, 2008. According to the Pew Research Center, weekday circulation in the newspaper industry fell 7%. Newsroom employment fell 10% in that year, and newspapers lost about 20,000 jobs, or almost 40% of the entire workforce within the past 20 years. So you're starting to see a very quick decline. It's picking up, and the worst part, I think, is that there's not really a lot of hope on the horizon for the printed newspaper to ever come back.
The big finger is being pointed at ad revenue. According to newspaper deathwatch.com, we saw 8% decline in newspaper ads last year and revenue from that. And that this is only the, in their minds, so, you know, the beginning of it, watching the death toll, if you will, of newspapers across the country. as these papers are trying to retrofit themselves in a similar model to what the New York Times has been doing, clearly the fact that people will pay something, not a whole lot, but they'll pay something for it, is changing everyone's perception of what that model looks like. What happens from this point forward as you see it?
Well, I was in New York not too long ago at Columbia University at a conference, and a New York Times editor was giving a presentation about their situation and revenue model. And essentially, in the last few years, the audience has moved from a print-based focus to a mobile-focused. And the New York Times at that point a few months ago was actually up to 60% of its audience on mobile devices. But the big problem was 70% of its revenue is still coming from print, and that's a similar dynamic in newspapers nationwide, where you have the audience wants to be on the mobile device and the revenue is coming from the print product, which is really causing a lot of problems.
Well, a clear disconnect in that way. So is there any hope on the horizon that you see for being able to at least capture eyeballs digitally and have, you know, some revenue coming in? And what happens to the shortfall?
Well, a couple things are happening, I think. Number one, we're getting more journalism than we've ever had before and better journalism than we've ever had before with all the different technological advances and opportunities for publishing. The downside is that people generally have not wanted to pay for that. Even the paywall at the New York Times is not, you know, made up for the revenue loss. And then very, very few papers have an audience as loyal as the New York Times. So you look at the Star Advertiser, for example, you know, to think that they're going to completely replace their print revenue with mobile revenue anytime soon is probably pretty far-fetched.
Which, again, brings us back to the fact that there's going to be a shortfall. There have been partnerships between universities and the creation of outlets like, you know, ProPublica and others, where there is a nonprofit model that's been brought out that is producing really good journalism. Are we, in fact, going to be seeing more of those and more partnerships in general just to be able to bring out good journalism and have it at a price point where people are willing to pay?
Well, I think that depends on the audience and what people want. If people want all their information to be public relations, marketing, advertising, trying to get them to buy things and trying to convince them of certain, you know, political viewpoints or, you know, trying to basically persuade them in certain directions, then that's what they'll get. But if they stick up for journalism by investing in it and paying a few dollars a month to support these organizations, I think journalism will not only come back, but it'll have its golden age.
So who are you seeing who's doing this really well?
Well, I mean, locally, I think there's a lot of interesting things happening on the digital platforms, from Civil Beat to the Star Advertiser to the television stations. I mean, it's interesting to think that although newspapers are really struggling, the television news is somewhat stable. So I think that's an indicator that people are interested in maintaining those channels. Now, you know, it depends on what people want to do with the content that used to be on newspapers. Do they want to support that on the digital platforms, or do they want to let that go away?
I was saying most people are getting their news from TV. That really hasn't changed. Civil Beat recently became a nonprofit. That seems to suggest that, that it's looking at a very different model.
Right. You have, you know, Civil Beat started as a for-profit venture and transformed into a nonprofit. I don't think at any point, you know, I don't know specifically the background of the company, but I don't think at any point it was intended to be a big profit mongering type organization. I think it was set up more for, you know, to improve the journalism in the community. But that said, I think a nonprofit model is great if you have billionaire backers and people who will pay for that and support it, including audience members who will, like with HBR, put in a few dollars every year to keep it going.
All right. Well, we've got to go. We're going to see how this continues to go. Thanks very much for the time this morning.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Brett Oppegard is an assistant professor at UH Manoa and served as the journalism undergraduate chair. He also writes a weekly column for Civil Beat about Hawaii media issues.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the documentary Hockney about the artist who created the Spalding House installation L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, August 11th and 18th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Water is without a doubt our most important resource. Without it, everything dies, including us. Unfortunately, scientists have determined that Hawaii's water supply is heading into a major decline. Rainfall and stream flows are down, and the evaporation rate is climbing. Because of climate change, Hawaii receives 20% less rainfall than in previous years. Scientists estimate within 15 years, Hawaii will likely receive substantially less rainfall than we will require. With an ever-increasing population, this means there's trouble ahead. The Hawaii Community Foundation saw this problem looming on the horizon and funded the Fresh Water Council, a group comprised of experts in water management. Despite their predictions of drought and land use change, the council is initiating plans to ensure there's no net loss of water. This is an example of a philanthropic effort that helps all of us, and one to which everyone will become donors. For the price of fresh water is constant vigilance, yours and mine. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered Hawaii's first international sumo star, a wrestler from Maui who became a champion and a mentor to the sumo wrestlers from Hawaii who followed in his wake. In 1972, he became the first foreigner to win a major tournament in Japan, the Emperor's Cup. When he did, a telegram from then-President Nixon was read in the sumo arena, the first time English had ever been officially spoken there. He retired after a 20-year career that made him into one of Japan's most popular athletes and became a Japanese citizen so he could open his own sumo stable. His stable recruited younger wrestlers from Hawaii, several of whom went on to successful careers in what had once been a sport for Japanese only. He retired in 1984, but the name of Jesse Kuhalua, also known as Takemiyama, is well-remembered by followers of the sport.
And it was well-remembered by Gail Kim, who called us. It was a very popular quiz today, but Gail Kim was first. She'll get the T-shirt. And at 8:49, that's today's Backyard Quiz. If you've got a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Kilauea Military Camp and the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park came into being 100 years ago thanks to the dedication of a colorful cast of characters in the volcano community at that time. The Kilauea Drama and Entertainment Network is presenting a live dramatic recreation of those days and those people with Kilauea 1916, a centennial celebration. Dick Hirschberger is the author and one of the performers, and he's on the line. Good morning, Dick.
Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
All right. You had quite a task in putting this show together. How'd you go about doing it?
Well, you know, I do the living history presentation as Tom Jagger at the volcano, and I expanded on the knowledge that I had from that. The research is, in some parts, is very difficult because Kilauea Military Camp has a wonderful, colorful history, but most of it happened after this period of time. So when Kilauea Military Camp came to Caden to ask about this, I started doing all the research I possibly could and came up with some really wonderful stories about KMC. And the volcano was just the natural add-on to that because they both celebrate the centennial at the same time.
Well, just to set the stage, Dick, who was Dr. Thomas Jagger?
Well, Tom Jagger was the volcanologist in 1912. He moved to live at Kilauea. He spent basically the balance of his life studying Kilauea. Came from MIT and did research there for a little over 60 years.
So how far along was he in 1916? What stage of his life was he at?
He was still studying desperately the volcano, which, of course, they're still doing today.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point in time, he became friends with Lauren Thurston and a group of people who were very taking advantage of the fact that that Kilauea was there and would become a potential tourist site. And he started studying the volcano there and became kind of a draw all of his own. He was quite a character.
Who were some of the other people in this, in your dramatic recreation?
Well, of course, Lauren Thurston was a major part of what was going on there, and also Governor Walter Freer was instrumental in making the whole program happen there.
Mm-hmm.
George Lycurgus was the manager of the Volcano House, and also Shizuka and Hideichi Yasunaga were people who worked around the Hawaii Volcanoes Observatory, and they were instrumental in seeing a lot of the things that happened there. And we've taken, in addition to those particular live or real characters, we've taken a couple of characters who are a composite of other people who lived around the volcano area at that point in time and who were instrumental in solidifying the park.
What kind of records were available to you to draw upon, Dick?
Well, certainly John Dvorak's new book, The Last Volcano, was a wonderful source of inspiration. And some of John Dvorak's writings previously on Jagger, which we've used extensively for history, for the program that I do on a weekly basis. And we look to them to that specifically to work on. And also, there's a lot of little piecemeal stuff that's out there about Jagger and the other people who were involved in the formation of the park. And, of course, the park records have also been used extensively.
When you're doing something like this, you sort of the historical material provides you with clues, and then you have to sort of extrapolate a character from what's available, yeah?
Exactly. And also we have to try to make it entertaining. So there are times when we'll take a piece of actual history and expand on it to make it entertaining.
What's an example of that, Dick?
Well, Tom Jagger was part of an expedition that went off when Tom was just out of high school in the late 1800s. And as a result of that, they were exploring all kinds of different parts of the western United States, and they got up into Yellowstone, and there's a story there about some bears that got trapped in a pit of CO2, carbon dioxide, which is heavier than air.
Mm-hmm.
And being trapped in there, they ended up dying of carbon dioxide poisoning.
Suffocating, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And it makes an interesting discussion when we're talking with people who are there to learn about the living history. And so my character of Tom Jagger talks about that. And we expand on that process a little bit.
The whole idea of imagining what kind of community there was in Volcano in 1916 is a fascinating exercise in itself, I would think.
Yes. Well, there were a great number of Japanese farmers who were providing produce for the Volcano House. And there are minor histories of about 8 or 10 of those people, but we kind of condensed those down into a single person and in the form of a fictitious person named Mitsue Tanaka. And she talks about her history being moved up to Volcano and being a vegetable farmer there and supplying produce to the Volcano House.
It must have been an exciting time in a lot of ways, I would think.
Oh, very definitely. And if you look at the music of that time, which we've incorporated into the program here as well, it was a period of wonderful, wonderful songs, and we have depended upon Carl Halimano to put together a series of songs that will be played as... So the program sets up as vignettes, and the vignettes are held together by utilizing Tom Jagger's wife, Isabel, and in a fictitious interview that she has with a reporter in Honolulu. And as she goes along and is talking about the things that happened in 1916,
that sounds like
vignettes come up.
Sounds like a really good framing device. Dick, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for the time. I appreciate
sure.
it.
Dick Hershberger is the author of Kilauea 1916, a centennial celebration of KMC and HVNP. It will be performed weekends from August 19th to 28th at Kilauea Military Camp's Kilauea Theater. Fridays and Saturdays are at 7:30, Sunday afternoons at 2:30. But then you and I grew up with the phrase, it's in the paper. Today, as I have breakfast, I read the paper. The whole thing of a physical entity that gave you your news was part of our growing up, yeah?
And the part of growing up for so many people in many, many, many decades and hundreds of years. But we've known for a long time now that that's been changing. And are we really seeing truly the end of that coming much more closer or coming closer to us than we thought? Probably.
The signs are all around us.
Well, certainly feeling bad for those people who are going to be outplaced from that. We'll see what arises in this next incarnation of how people find their way to good journalism.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for us for this Monday morning. Tomorrow, we're going to have a conversation with Hawaii County mayoral candidate and once upon a time mayor, Harry Kim.
And we'll look at the value of medicinal herbs.
You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or call us at 808-792-8217 if you'd like to make your comments known.
You can find past shows on our archive with a conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning back here for more of The Conversation.